Hi, welcome to Infill, a podcast by the YIMBY Party, where we discuss local San Francisco politics and policy. Today, we are with people who I'm kind of obsessed with, San Francisco Transformation, the Banksys of bike infrastructure. They go around and put up rogue but necessary infrastructure to save the lives of bikers. So I'm Laura Clark, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
My alias, because we're an anonymous group, is Rocky. And we also do pedestrian infrastructure as well. That's just as important to us.
Hi, and I am Cone Guy, another one of our anonymous group.
And I'm Brian Hillen with the YIMBY Party, who is also a huge fanboy.
So recently, you guys made some big news by putting up some bike infrastructure that the SFMTA said actually was really good, and they were just going to leave it there, which I'm sure was like a crowning jewel moment for you guys. I'd love to hear more about that experience of installing that and then watching as your beautiful project was left to flourish.
Hi, Cone Guy here. So this project started out, we saw a tweet from someone who recounted an experience where she was nearly hit in that bike lane as a large vehicle was making the turn, didn't see her cut into the bike lane, and came within inches of hitting her. And we took a look at that location, and it looked like a no-brainer. I mean, you stick a couple posts here, drivers on average are going to give a little extra space and go around and leave the bike lane open for cyclists. At the same time, it's going to slow people down. You're narrowing the roadway. You're making the turn a little tighter. It's going to slow people down for pedestrians in the crosswalk at that location. So we did a couple tests with orange cones. They worked well until somebody removed the cones, and then cars were back in the bike lane. So we decided to do something a little more permanent. We got some of the same white safe hit posts that the city already uses all over the city to protect bike lanes. And we installed them. So the posts are pretty easy to order online. There's a bunch of different traffic safety companies that supply them. So, and installing them was even easier than we expected as well.
We're doing this because the city's not doing this. We're seeing cars going really, really fast in Golden Gate Park. We're seeing cars park in bike lanes in Golden Gate Park. We're seeing pedestrians live in sort of terror crossing crosswalks in Golden Gate Park. And to us, this seemed like a no-brainer, and we wanted to show to government officials and bikers and pedestrians how easy solutions like this could be to make people feel safer on the streets.
So how did you guys get into this in the first place? I'm sure that was like, you know, we've seen a lot of bicycle-related deaths, and the city recently adopted a policy of Vision Zero to bring pedestrian and bicycling deaths down, hopefully to zero. You know, how did you get involved in all of this?
It started in early this summer when the MTA put a painted bike lane on Golden Gate Avenue, and a number of us on Twitter who sort of talk about pedestrian and bicycle safety noticed that cars were driving right down the middle of this bike lane. And so we got together and we said, let's get some orange cones and let's make this so that this is safe for bikers. And I think that was the start of this. And we saw immediately that there was sort of excitement and support among the community to do this. And we started collecting donations on our Twitter account.
The other part of the inspiration, there's groups like this around the country, notably in Portland, Boston, and New York City that have been operating mostly since, I guess, about a year ago at this point, October 2015. And I think a number of us have been watching these groups and been thinking, why don't we have this here? Why don't we have this here? And for a number of us as well, the night of June 22nd, when two cyclists were killed in the same evening, was just sort of a turning point, a snapping point. We can't just sit here anymore and wait for things to get better. We need to do something to make it happen.
So I was at that same memorial ride for the two cyclists who were killed. And as a cyclist who sees unsafe behavior on every single block that I bike on for years, it's been really frustrating to me that a city that pays Lyft service to cyclist safety, that passed a transit-first policy all the way back in the 1970s, just really is not enforcing pedestrian and cyclist safety. So for those of us who, you know, feel like you do and who have just been upset and wanting to do something, how do we get involved?
So the work that we're doing, is it doesn't actually require a ton of labor and people to get out there and do the installation specifically. We definitely accept donations. We love for people to go to our website and add locations to our map that you think are dangerous, whether or not we can do something about them. It's a resource that even the city could refer to see these are really dangerous locations. And I think we also want people to get out there and do this on their own. If you see a location that is really dangerous and you can think of an easy way to fix it, do it. At the same time, there's a lot of other ways to get involved in advocating for street safety that I think we have all done and felt a little frustrated with, going to City Hall and giving public comment, writing in with your thoughts about proposed changes to streets. But direct action is something that we felt like needed to happen.
Yeah, I've been to a lot of, obviously I've been to a lot of hearings, but a lot of the transit hearings, especially of late, have been sort of really heated. And I know you guys have been to some of these hearings as well. You know, what do you feel like the opposition to this project mostly comes from?
It's hard to tell. It's not quite as black and white as some of the protests we've seen around the transit improvements on Terravel, where people are talking about parking, but it probably starts with parking. I think a year or two ago, there was the public hearings about the Polk Street bike lane, and we saw a lot of strong objections to that. And I think we're seeing the construction start right now, and we're hoping that the city puts the highest level of protection for bicyclists and pedestrians. But I think the status quo in the city, which is still happening to this day, is that you're getting these projects watered down to accommodate parking, to accommodate businesses who are concerned about other things. And so you end up having these bike lanes that are sort of painted on the street, but people, Lyft car drivers, delivery trucks, are just parking in the bike lanes. And we see an absence of urgency in city government around this. There's been some movement in the MTA with support from the Bike Coalition. Since these deaths in June, the mayor has issued this directive, but we still see sort of an absence of urgency on this issue. And so for us, we wanted to put some facts on the ground so that everyone could say, hey, this isn't that expensive, this isn't that disruptive. It lets people on the streets, on pedestrians and bicyclists, feel how it can be safer. And I think we want to inspire the city and the mayor's office and the police department to upgrade the quality of infrastructure we see going in, and of course do enforcement.
Yeah, one of the candidates that we have endorsed for BART bond, Latifah Simon, she talks a lot, really powerfully and compellingly, about how public transportation and bike infrastructure is a social justice issue. And she really carries that message forward of sort of, these are the ways that people need to get to their jobs, need to move around the cities, and especially for people who can't afford to or don't want to own cars. And a lot of the work that we think and do about is, how do we retrofit our cities so that they are, you know, density and health oriented? How do we create healthy cities where people are moving around in that city in a way that is healthy and productive and vibrant? You know, I'm wondering how you guys see sort of the future of the city fitting into your vision.
Yeah, I think we completely agree that walking, biking, and transit are the cheapest, the healthiest, the most efficient ways to get around a city. And so especially for lower income folks who rely on their own 2 feet to get to and from work, we need to create cities that are that put those modes of transit first. And right now we're recovering, I think, around the country from an era when cars were put first everywhere.
I think we see protected bike lanes. We see shorter crosswalks. We see decreased speed on city streets. We see zero tolerance for speeding down these wide avenues in SoMa and in the outer neighborhoods. And we see transit-only lanes. I think that's the future of dense cities that we're excited about. And I think, you know, this is where I feel like San Francisco city government is failing us. I don't know. I mean, people who travel to Europe or even to New York City, where they've had a progressive transit administration under Mayor Bloomberg in particular, you see the same sort of solutions, like painted bulb outs and bike lanes, taken, at least at an infrastructure level, a step or two further than what we have here. We have paint and we have plastic posts to protect pedestrians in Soma in particular, where people drive very, very fast. And that's just not enough. And we see these little steps that we want the city government to take the leadership on and have the courage to say, this is our highest priority. And right now we're not seeing that in very many city departments, despite, I think, people, particularly in the MTA, who have the best of intentions and propose ambitious projects, but we watch them get watered down and sort of abandoned when the politics hits the road.
I'd like you to talk about your plans for Soma a little bit more. You've gotten a lot of praise for putting those soft hit posts on a Folsom, where I used to live on Folsom Street. I would bike down all the time, and it really is very unsafe. And it just blows me away that in this area where there's so much transit, we have, you know, 5 lanes of traffic going one way with a lane of parking on each side of the street. Why are we doing this in some of the most valuable real estate on earth? What would you like to see San Francisco do with these, you know, these incredibly wide streets?
So I definitely want to say that our group can only do so much. We can make small incremental changes on our own. A huge part of our goal is to get the city, like you said, to commit to these big transformations. And that's what we need. We need entire street transformations all over the city, dramatically decreasing the amount of space for motor vehicles and increasing the space for walking, biking, and public transit. In terms of little things that we can do, we would love to see more parking-protected bike lanes in Soma. There's enough street space that you can do that. You can put the bike lane by the curb, and then you can leave a buffer and you can have a row of parked cars, and that helps make pedestrians and cyclists safer. It gets the fast-moving vehicles further away from the vulnerable road users. And there's definitely some small improvements that our group might be able to make on some of these big streets. We have some ideas in mind that hopefully will come to fruition soon. But it's the whole street transformations that the city has to enact and has to show the leadership and just make it happen.
I think that, you know, giving an example of what we're seeing in the city and what we want to see in the city, I think Golden Gate Park and JFK Drive is a good example, where the city made a gesture of building quote-unquote protected bike lanes on that street. And what that is they've painted the parking lanes on the outside of the bike lane. But if you ride there on the weekend or on the weekdays, particularly when the roads are open to cars, to speeding cars, you see cars get disoriented and just park in the bike lane. And so the city has, for reasons that we don't entirely understand, lost the ability to install things called curbs between parking spots and the bike lane. And we've asked for that, and they say we don't really get a clear answer for why that's not something that's able to be done. And so we've seen the city put these sort of soft hit posts, these very sort of fragile little signposts, in between some things on Division Street where they're doing parking protected lanes. But right now there is planning afoot, and there's public hearings about protecting a few blocks of 7th and 8th. This is sort of the mayor's office and the MTA's reaction to those deaths in June. And there, I think it's only 4 blocks in each way that's going to be parking protected. And we don't know if there's going to be these things called curbs installed here. But we really want to see the city's commitment to building permanent infrastructure to protect vulnerable users of our streets.
Yeah, I'm always struck when I see those soft hit posts by how many of them have been hit repeatedly. I mean, it's kind of terrifying. I also, you know, I've tried to walk home repeatedly from this office, and I have to go through that section of the city where the highways come together. And you end up on dead end sidewalks, and you can't figure out how to cross, you know, 4 or 6 lanes of highway that are merging to get up onto the highway. And it's not to mention, there's also tons of single story warehouses and tent encampments all around that area. I mean, for me, that area of the city that should be our crowning jewel, should be a dense, vibrant heart of our city, you know, goes to show that we've prioritized cars over human beings in this very visceral way. I'm wondering if there's other parts of the city, or if you want to talk about that, where you just sort of see our priorities being out of whack.
I think Golden Gate Park is a great example where our priorities are out of whack. Golden Gate Park has a great number of roadways. I go jogging in there from time to time as well, and I see cars traveling 40, 50, 60 miles an hour on narrow passageways, and it's sort of a cut around to get from the Sunset to the Richmond and back. I think we'd like to see the speed slow down there. We'd like to see pedestrian and bicycle use prioritized, and park use, of course, prioritized over it being a thoroughfare for automobiles. I think, again, we'd like to see permanent infrastructures that so that people feel safe biking and walking in that park, and jogging in my case. And we'd like to see that prioritized urgently. And I think part of that is also enforcement. I think we've seen some preliminary data that the San Francisco Police Department in some districts has prioritized focus on the five, and I have to remember what the five, and they're the things that lead to the most road injuries and deaths. We've seen some movement towards that, but I think we really need to, we'd like to live in a city where when you see someone driving 40 miles an hour down Market Street, your expectation is, oh, they're going to be ticketed right away. There's just zero tolerance for this. And that's the city that we want to live in. And that's why we think pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure that makes people walking in Soma feel safe, where I don't think a lot of people feel really safe right now. I think those are the transformations we want to see.
I think that's a great point. And just this idea of feeling safe as a pedestrian. I was on went out to eat on a 6th Street a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I see cars honking at pedestrians crossing against the lights all the time. And I'm thinking, you have to wait like 120 seconds or more in order to get the pedestrian signal across what's basically a highway. I don't blame any of these neighbors for disregarding these signals and just, jaywalking, which is a term that the, you know, car lobbying industry invented about 100 years ago or whatever. But, you know, more than just sort of enforcement and signal priority, it seems to me that the problem is that our roads are engineered this way. And part of what you're talking about, right, isn't just enforcement. It's an actual transformation of our streets to make it so that a car couldn't drive 60 miles an hour down the road, even if they wanted to.
Yeah, I would agree. Safe streets are obviously a combination of three things: engineering, enforcement, and education. But to a large degree, if you have the engineering in place, the education and the enforcement don't matter. You can build streets that make it physically impossible to do these dangerous behaviors. And the MTA might not, in some cases, believe that it's possible, or might think that it's too costly, might say that it's going to take too long, but it's possible, and it needs to be done. And part of this vision, I think, like Rocky was describing, Golden Gate Park is supposed to be a beautiful green space that people can enjoy, and it's hurt by the fact that there are so many cars there speeding through. And I also have a vision for spaces, for example, Valencia Street, Haight Street, that could be completely pedestrianized. You could have cafes sort of, you know, falling into the street and people walking everywhere, buses coming through down a middle lane. I have this beautiful vision of these streets that are all of a sudden converted for people. And that's something that we don't really have here.
I think one other point we want to make is that San Francisco, viewed globally as this sort of hub of innovation, I think we've failed to address changes on our streets like car sharing, or what do you call it, Lyft and Uber. I don't think we've created space for that. We've just sort of assumed that you get to go on the street. And I think the result is a lot of density and gridlock and frustration on the streets of San Francisco. And the city government, you know, in many ways, very connected to the tech community, has failed to prototype and innovate to solve for these challenges that we face on our streets. So if the solution for double parking and drop-offs on Valencia Street is more loading zones and less parking, I think we'd like to see the city try things like that. But right now what we have is we have a collision of users on our streets and a lot of frustration, particularly among car drivers. And so I think Valencia Street's an interesting example of how might we make it safer for pedestrians, for cyclists, for deliveries, and for car sharing. And right now the city's just saying, we don't really know.
There are a lot of other groups kind of active in this space right now. I mean, Bicycle Coalition is a really powerful group in the city, Walk SF. You know, there's a couple other groups. You know, I really enjoy, you guys are sort of the direct action kind of putting, you know, putting policy into practice, whether anybody likes it or not, which I find really cool. And I'm wondering sort of how you guys see other people in the space, how you guys see yourselves as political actors and sort of enacting change.
So I think we're all big fans of the Bike Coalition, Walk SF, these other organizations that are doing great work to advocate for these changes. But they can't necessarily do what we're doing. They would sacrifice a lot of their political power by doing that. But that doesn't mean that a group like ours shouldn't exist. I think we need to have a lot of different groups approaching these issues from different angles, with different perspectives, with different tactics. And if we fight this from all sides, it could really make a big difference.
Anything else you guys want to add? I think this has been really great.
I think I want to encourage people to imagine what our streets could be like in the future, and take action if you feel like it's safe and appropriate. We want this to be something of a, we want this to be a viral movement. We don't want to be the roadblock to people making their streets safer. We have a member of our community who's said that he wants to make a particularly knotty intersection in the Sunset safer, and he's gone to the Home Depot to buy some supplies, and he's going to try it out and prototype it. And I think we want to encourage everyone in San Francisco, in the East Bay, elsewhere, and around the country to try things new, to prototype things, and to show city leaders and other road users that you can do this and in a way that works.
Yeah, I completely agree. Part of the reason we would like to be anonymous is that we're not some small group of people doing this for ourselves. We're trying to represent everyone's interests, and we're trying to encourage everybody to take this upon themselves and become part of this larger group. So if you would like to learn more about our group, how you can get involved, how you can start doing this on your own, we do have a website, sfmtra.org. There's more information there. There's more information coming soon. Please get in touch with us if you've got questions, if you want to learn how you can do what we're doing and help spread this movement.
Thank you so much to our secret gentleman. Now we're going to transition, and joined with us is Sylvia Mahan.
Hi.
So it's Sylvia, Brian, and I talking about the week in local YIMBY.
Yeah, so this week in local politics, the San Francisco Examiner came out with an interesting article basically accusing Ron Conway and Laura Foote Clark of being best friends, and also painting quite a picture of the kind of evil tech money influencing elections. And I think there's no one really better to shine a light on what's true and what's not than Laura.
I'd like to ask a direct question here. Laura, how long have you been coordinating with Ron Conway to make San Francisco a tech-only city?
Since before you were born. Yeah, you are. Well, that's not a real question. But it was really actually the really ridiculous part is I also help out with this local news aggregator thing called SF Usual Suspects. And so I woke up in the morning and had to news aggregate a article about me. I was very, very awkward. Yes. I do think it's a really worthwhile topic of conversation of like the role of money in politics and how it gets spent and when it gets spent and how useful it actually ends up being. We've seen, I think people try to be sort of on both sides of this. They've been really mad at tech for not being involved at all. They've been really mad at tech workers for kind of seeming to not be engaged in what's happening in the city. And now we're trying to get techies to vote. And tech, the industry is, saying we need to do a lot to make the city function better because they live here. And everyone's, mad at them for that, which, I understand money in politics is scary. But I also think, there's a lot of money in politics, and the tech money is actually not even the biggest piece of the puzzle.
You made a really good point right there in talking about that tech has been criticized for its employees not getting involved, and yet now it's getting criticized for its employees being involved. And this article did a sort of neat rhetorical trick where at the one hand, the headline is talking about dark money, and it isn't. It's open for public review. But there is a fair amount of money involved, which is a problem. But then saying how accusing you of trying to organize tech workers to advocate on behalf of their own interests, to be involved in the governance of San Francisco, to be good, you know, citizens. And I think that what they were doing was really just delegitimizing any sort of space for tech to be involved in local politics by saying it's the exact same thing for tech workers to show up at a committee hearing saying that to keep a shuttle program as it is for Ron Conway or whoever to be directing funds.
I mean, I actually see a role for both. And maybe that's, you know, I'm a pragmatist at heart. I think that anybody who's a mass employer in the area has an incentive to say, I'm paying my employees vast sums of money and they are still miserable because so much of their money is being siphoned off to landlords. And they, you know, that one of the solutions is to keep raising how much they pay their employees, which I think, you know, anytime you're paying workers more, I am for that. But I think we're seeing, you know, income inequality. It's a big problem. So one of the solutions they've gone for is just paying more and more and more money to their employees. But the real problem is how much their employees are spending on rent. And they're, you know, starting to say, we need to fix this. Because millennials want to live in cities, right? I think we have to sort of think about the whole piece of it is who, like, they are beholden to their employees in a lot of ways. You know, their employees are very intelligent, can job hop, can city hop, have a broad perspective. And they want to live in the top 10 cities in America. They don't want to live in, you know, they're trying to move a lot of these people out to Phoenix. And, like, it's a struggle because, like, you know, Phoenix is okay. But, like, you know, there's not a lot. I don't want to drag too hard on Phoenix. But, like, you know, their employees want to live in San Francisco and want to live in a deeply urban place. They don't want to own cars. They hate their long commute. And they like that they at least can do it on a bus and don't have to be driving themselves. You know, all of the things, this is the thing I think about all the time. We spent the entirety of the 80s like training people with our movies and whatnot that the suburbs were a dystopian hellscape where you were going to be lonely and driving in your car and fat and miserable and alienated from society. And like our generation really learned that lesson, right? We like want to come and live in cities. And now they didn't build to that capacity. There wasn't a realization that we would have this level of people wanting to be in urban, diverse, interesting, coffee shop laden environments.
I also think it's interesting when you know, I see other cities around the country look at San Francisco and the resistance to the tech community and are kind of in shock because here's this amazing engine of growth that is helping the Bay Area as a whole to really have a vibrant economy where a lot of other places are struggling. And then yet there's resistance to that. So can you talk a little bit about how actually, you know, having a tech community benefits the entire city?
Yeah, I mean, I say this all the time, like having a booming economy should not cripple a region. That means you're doing something wrong. And what we've done wrong is chronically underbuild housing in the Bay Area for decades. We know that that's what we did wrong. And then additionally, you know, it is an engine for growth. All of these tech workers are also potential people shopping and dining and eating and buying art and jewelry and engaging. You know, if they weren't commuting also so much, I think this is a part that we don't think about, right? They're spending like 2 hours commuting every day. How much of their time and life could be spent fully enjoying the urban environment that they want to be in? I mean, what percentage of them are going off to Burning Man, right? Where it's just like a ridiculous art extravaganza. I mean, absurd, but also like an expression of human ingenuity too. You know, they want to be able to be here. And we've kind of, in a lot of ways, structurally locked a lot of these people out. And we've made it, when you chronically underbuild housing, you make it a one in, one out system. We've made it a competition between the tech workers and the other people. And I understand, I mean, I viscerally understand why people who are afraid of being displaced, they look at the tech worker and they know that tech worker is here and displacing someone, you know, because we have chronically underbuilt housing. And to say that the enemy isn't really the tech worker, the enemy is this abstract notion of a lack of supply of housing, it is a hard argument to really convince somebody of when they're experiencing that visceral everyday, I'm going to lose my home.
Yeah, Laura, I think you make a really great point when talking about how a booming economy should not be crippling to a region. It's a totally paradoxical thing to be happening. You know, and what I think this really shows is that San Francisco is an incredibly rich region. All of our problems are entirely of our own making. These are policy problems that can be fixed through politics, electing people to push for better policy. What we need right now is more housing. What we need right now is a better transit system. What we need right now are more homeless services. All of these things could be funded for a even boomier economy. You know, we can capture this, you know, tech wealth directed to those ends instead of just letting incumbent homeowners have their, you know, prices increase forever and capturing all the benefits of the tech boom.
It's kind of this funny thing. It's like the tech companies don't want to pay for these stupid shuttle buses, right? Like I don't even know what part of their budget is spent on these stupid giant buses that shuttle people from San Francisco down to the South Bay, right? I mean, that's a ridiculous waste of their money. And they only do it because there's not enough housing in the South Bay. There's not enough housing here, but there's way not enough housing in the South Bay. No one wants to live there because it's a suburban dystopian hellscape full of office. I mean, I don't know if you've been down there. I don't know why the people who are down there really want to preserve it, because it was built as this car-centric sprawlandia that they're desperately trying to preserve. It's baffling to me. But in addition to that, if there was a well-functioning public transportation system that got people from San Francisco to the South Bay, we would not have tech shuttle buses. That is a entirely politically manufactured problem.
I'd like to push back on one thing that you said, though, talking about the abstract villain of a lack of housing supply. Well, the villain don't need to be all that abstract. There are real people today pushing for no housing production or much less housing production than we actually need. So anyone who goes to a Board of Supervisors meeting can, you know, look at the villains. You can see the homeowners who are advocating and organizing for less housing, who bought their home for $188,000 20 years ago and are now, you know, it's now worth $1.5 million, and they're paying taxes on only $250,000 of it. I mean, this is a very common thing all throughout the Bay Area. So if you need, you know, someone to hate to get involved in politics, there are plenty of people out there.
So, yeah, that is a really good point. But I'm going to try to shift us back on topic because I think we could talk about this all day. But let's get back to the question of dark money, or just generally money in politics, and specifically in the local races that are happening now. You know, we saw the San Francisco Examiner article, but it doesn't tell the whole story, right, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, people really like think about a PAC giving to another PAC. So this is one of the ways in which money gets collected in politics, is that you'll have like a consultant who will, you know, create a PAC that will collect money from different people and whatnot in order to then redistribute it. And the premise is that that person knows what they're doing more than the people who are donating the money. And I think especially in tech, you know, most of these companies and people, you know, the companies are like 10 years old max, you know, and the people are getting involved in politics kind of for the first time, and they don't necessarily know what to do with their money to be effective. And so, you know, they give it to somebody who's then going to give it to somebody else who they think actually can move the needle. I'm not sure how accurate and sort of useful that sort of moving of the needle has been. But you can contrast that with another group that's been giving very heavily in this election cycle, which is the soda companies. And this is not their first rodeo. So they've fought soda taxes around the country and also in San Francisco. So in the last time we tried to have a soda tax, they spent between $9 and $10 million and narrowly defeated a previous soda tax.
Just to highlight this, because I think it's really important point to emphasize, which is that this idea that tech is the industry that is trying to kind of take over San Francisco and put a ton of money into politics so that it kind of can have its say, makes it seem like you know, tech is trying to take over San Francisco. And yet there's not enough conversation about what Big Soda is doing. And I think people who would, you know, a lot of people would be angry about tech being involved would be maybe even more angry knowing Big Soda's influence.
You'd think that, except that the money from Big Soda is largely going to the people who are complaining about the tech industry. And so if you look at, say, Jane Kim, who's chief political strategist, is also a political strategist who gets a lot of money from the soda industry as well. So, you know, they're in a sense buying off the opposition using this, you know, faux progressive rhetoric saying, oh, you know, increased soda taxes are more deeply felt for low-income people. That's true. And so is diabetes. I mean, like, we are trying to create a healthier city by passing these taxes. And, you know, a lot of folks who think of themselves as progressive are really on the wrong side of this issue.
I want to draw a clear line like you were talking about. So it's the main person is Storefront Media and Eric Jay, who is the chief consultant both for the soda lobby and for the branded progressive Jane Kim.
Branded progressive, that was a really nice title.
I'm sorry, I'm a progressive, so I don't think they earn that title when you're advocating for regressive policies. So yes, I do. The other ones we use are faux-gressive and regressive. I like regressive because it really touches on this like faux nostalgia that they have for like bringing us back to, you know, it's like the same kind of like make America great again. It's like some imaginary San Francisco that they used to live in. In any case, so Eric Jay is the chief consultant for both the soda lobby and Jane Kim, and is sort of a big cheese that has been in San Francisco local faux-gressive politics for a long time. And, you know, so he's doing everything at once, you know. I mean, that's the kind of, I have a huge amount of respect, right? That's brilliant. I mean, he knows how to move the money and have the money do twice the work. By being the consultant for multiple people who then can be aligned, you can leverage that money to be much more powerful. So, you know, they're doing things like spending $40,000 for the tenants union, which then is also advocating no on the soda tax. So that it's $40,000 of soda money that goes to the tenants union to send out their mailers citywide, which does then a suite of things because it's, you know, advocating against Marjan, it's advocating for Jane Kim, it's advocating, you know, also against the soda tax, and it looks very anti-corporate because it's the tenants union. I mean, that's frankly, that's brilliant. Okay, like I'm like lots of respect for that kind of like political jujitsu. You know, we know that they're spending at least $600,000. The soda industry has spent at least $600,000 so far. We know that they also are banking $9 million for ads that they're going to blast out in the last week. I just think they're really freaking smart.
Also, if you're kind of wondering what I haven't really heard about this soda tax thing, but you have received a flyer that tells you to vote against the grocery tax, that's the soda tax. It is not a grocery tax. It is a soda tax. And that's really misleading. So kind of, you know, boils my blood to think about that by itself. But then when you also realize how much money is being spent on that lie, it's really upsetting.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's funny because like I don't get upset by much anymore. I definitely take the attitude of like, oh my God, they're so brilliant. Like I want to do anything I can to defeat them. But I also am like, I need to learn their like magical ways of political manipulation.
Don't do it, Laura. Don't do it.
I know, right? But it's like anything to improve this city, right? Like whatever we can do. I mean, we have a huge amount of work to do. I mean, we have to retrofit our city. I mean, you were listening to these guys talking about like basically getting a curb, you know, like they're doing all this work. What can we do with that freaking $10 million that the soda industry is spending on this race? So they spent $10 million on the last one. We think it's going to be $14 million on this race. Like, that's nuts. We could buy a new city. Okay, that's an exaggeration, but...
Let's be real. $14 million maybe buys 14 houses for, you know, below market rate houses right now. But, you know, speaking of drawing a bright line, though, what did the Examiner article talk about with the tech money? $1.2 million. that's not a gigantic, huge amount that's going to, you know, get their folks elected and make Mayor Lee emperor for life or whatever it is that the so-called progressives are afraid of. This is real money from the soda industry. And the fact is, here in San Francisco, both sides do it. This is just how it works. And one other thing, this is not dark money. I know some think I'm just being too pedantic talking about this, but dark money is when you don't know who the donors are. Dark money is giving to a C4 or a C6 who doesn't need to reveal their donors, and you obscure it. All of this, you can go to sfethics.org and find out all this, which is what the journalists at the San Francisco Examiner did.
Okay, so I do push back on your pedantic dark money, gray money, whatever. I am one of those people who's like, you're being pedantic. I do think, though, that, you know, I don't like that there's, I get my paycheck now from there being money in politics, you know? So I have to like think about these things of, you know, most of our donors, I don't know whether it was the last time I checked, it was like 90% of our donors were giving $200 or less. You know, most, we have a huge grassroots people who donate, you know, we throw parties where people buy $20 tickets kind of things, or, and we give a lot of tickets away for free. And, you know, it's really, you know, we are grassroots. And yet, you know, could we do everything we do if we didn't get, you know, a $1,000 donation every once in a while? You know, I don't think we would not be able to do this. So I'm off two minds about money and politics in general, because, you know, we've done a lot of damage in some cases for like getting rid of pork barrel spending, for instance. We used to be able to broker deals, you know, in the legislative branch by saying, you know, quid pro quo a little bit between legislators. And when we stopped allowing pork barrel spending, which seemed like a really good idea, you know, a lot of our basic functions of government ground to a halt.
I think that's exactly right. And it's an underappreciated point by those who advocate for getting money out of politics, for those who advocate for good government in general. If you destroy transactional politics, what are you left with? Just politics based on values? Well, that's just conflict. Like, values are often irreconcilable. And so then the people on the other side of the aisle aren't potential partners where you get your funding for, fingers crossed, new bike infrastructure, and they get their funding for, you know, a water reclamation project or whatever. Now it's, you are evil. You are fighting on the other side. I cannot work with you. And that's a real problem for, you know, American politics right now.
I get a lot of the you're evil things, you know, and I, you know, honestly, it does. It's troubling to me. It's not how I see myself. It's really weird to be advocating for integrated communities and a lot more housing and getting rid of systemic racism in our housing policies, and then to be accused of being a ringleader for the Klan, right? Yeah. Like, this is a weird, it's weird. And I don't know how, I don't know whether these kinds of things are worth sort of talking back to and pushing back against. You know, I had this incident where we were launching during the mass mobilization, and I was trying to like talk to some of our volunteers and get them going, and they had never canvassed before, you know, and they're kind of like a little skittish because canvassing for the first time, you just sort of don't know what to expect. And this guy just starts, you know, some random guy just starts screaming about how we are killing people. And, you know, I'm like, I'm happy to sit here and have coffee with you and talk through this issue for the next hour, but can you please let me get my volunteers out the door? You know, we have people who we're giving material support to a couple of other allied organizations who are advocating for good things. So the BART bond, the Vote 16. So that's lowering the voting age to 16.
That's Yes on F.
Yes on F and RR. And we've offered it to other people. So we've offered it to like the immigrant voting people.
Prop N.
Yes, Prop N. You know, I think those are anybody who's sort of for something that we see as like a positive, good future of the city. You know, we want to like, we have space to do phone banking. That's a call out to anybody. You know, we have space if you want to have a meeting, if you want to use our space for phone banking. You know, when we didn't have space, it was such a struggle. And now And then to be sort of have that like thrown back in my face, you know, it's difficult. I mean, San Francisco politics is weird and difficult.
Yeah, when I first started getting involved, and as someone who has always thought of myself as an actual progressive, even a leftist, and getting called developer shill, I'm trying to, you know, ethnically cleanse the mission. I mean, I got, you know, really ugly charges thrown at me when I'm getting involved. You know, I had to do some reality checks with old friends of mine in Chicago and in D.C. And it's like, so I haven't become some neoliberal shill, right? Like, this is what I'm advocating for, and this is what the opposition is saying. And, you know, I remember one guy who actually organizes with socialists in Chicago said, no, you're right. I don't know what they're talking about. And that's the sort of thing. And it's like one of the reasons that I really encourage people who move to San Francisco, who think of themselves as a progressive, to read about the history of the progressive movement in this city. And what you find is that, well, it's a very weird kind of progressivism. It was forged in the 1970s by mostly a bunch of professional class white people who moved here from elsewhere, and they moved into their neighborhoods and they liked them just fine, and they've been fighting change ever since. Progressivism really is more of a reactionary movement in San Francisco, where you say, you know, I moved here in 1974 and I want to keep San Francisco looking, you know, the same. And they sort of also talk about other stuff that we agree with. Like, I'm sure they were, you know, Tim Redman was probably against the Iraq War as well, right? I mean, like, these like larger issues we agree on. But when it comes to land use, who gets to live here? You know, they're on the wrong side of this. And one last thing, a point that you brought up earlier about how every time a new person moves to San Francisco, it really is this sort of one-for-one displacement pressure because the existing residents aren't allowing new housing. Well, Tim Redman has talked about this. He's advocated for a system much like what they have in China, where it's a sort of internal passport control system, where he said tech workers should have to wait in Stockton first, and then when their like number comes up, then they can move here. This is insane.
Can you just clarify who Tim Redman is for those who don't know?
Tim Redman is the founder and editor-in-chief of 48 Hills, which London Breed called, what was it again, a bullshit-ass blog? I don't want to misquote the great London Breed here. And he was formerly the longtime editor of The Bay Guardian, someone who's been fighting, you know, housing development in San Francisco for many, many decades.
I've had surreal conversations with, like, somebody who leads affordable housing development, Choo Choo, it's Peter Cohen, where I gave him sort of an abstract, would you rather, like, I was like, okay, we've talked around and around this issue. You know, would you rather have, to distill it down, a higher percentage affordable housing units on a smaller project, so lower total number, or a lower percentage but a higher total number of units on like a bigger project? You know, you only get to choose one. I'm going to distill it down. And he chose the lower total number, higher percentage. And I was like, I mean, literally your one job is to build affordable housing units. Like, that is like, that is your one job, and you are prioritizing something else over the one thing you're supposed to be caring about. And like, I don't know, and there's all these other words that you can add on top of that to be like, well, it's really about blah. No. No, what it's really about is that you are supposed to want to build as many affordable housing units as possible, and everything else, I'm sorry, is just bullshit.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard Peter advocate for the exact same thing at other public meetings. So this isn't just some one-off conversation that Laura had. This is his policy. But wait a minute, is this his one job? I would argue it's not, and that it sounds like, oh, you're the Council of Community Housing Organizations, you're trying to make San Francisco more affordable, you want more affordable housing. Really, let's look at the origins of this organization, founded by Calvin Welsh, back in the day, a community activist from the Upper Haight who's been fighting housing production for many decades. And I would say that really what Peter's job is, he's a manager of a quote-unquote progressive political coalition who, at their core, they are concerned with slowing growth. That is his main job, is to actually stop housing production, I think. That's why he got this job. That's why Choo Choo was formed. It's not to create more affordable housing units so San Francisco you know, can house more lower-income people.
Okay, if I bought into that conspiracy theory, which I know there's a lot of evidence for, I would just like might just slit my wrists. So I'm going to like pretend that these people just, you know, came, you know, they cut their teeth at a very different time, right? They when they first got involved in local politics and were sort of like, I think most of your beliefs get set, you know, sort of between 17 and 28, let's say. Most of your fundamental beliefs about the world are set at that time. And at that time, you know, for them, we were blasting through our cities with highways. We were doing a lot of quote unquote redevelopment, which basically meant blasting through ghettos and, you know, putting in whatever infrastructure that, you know, the man who did not care about the well-being of, you know, the small people in the world. And, you know, they learned their lessons about fighting the powers that be, you know, in a way that is not applicable now. And that's the real struggle, is that things have really changed. Who the enemy is has really fundamentally changed.
That's one thing that makes me really sad about this whole conflict, is that if there weren't people trying to block all housing, if there wasn't suggestions of moratoriums on housing, then we could actually all be working together to ensure that there is a larger percentage of affordable housing and that people aren't getting displaced. And I think, you know, YIMBY is doing that. That is one of the things that YIMBY advocates for. But we have to spend a lot of time just trying to get people to stop blocking housing, period, which is frustrating.
Yeah, and one thing that we struggle with all the time is when someone proposes something that sounds like, you know, oh, like the density done right by Aaron Peskin proposal. You know, that was something that sounded like it was going to be a great compromise where we all win, but actually was designed to slow density and to stop it. I mean, you know, these, it's so frustrating because we get a lot of people who are proposing things deliberately that are wolves in sheep clothing that are actually anti-housing policies.
That's right. You know, I take your point that so many of the worldview of the quote unquote progressives in San Francisco really was forged in a very different era when the battles were different. They should have been fighting to stop highways blasting through cities. They should have been fighting urban renewal. Like, these were terrible programs that led to massive displacement and all sorts of bad urban policy. That said, if you look at present day, what are affordable housing advocates fighting for and advocating for in Sacramento and in other communities in California that aren't San Francisco? They're very different things. You know, the fact that you can have, you know, Peter Cohen, the head of Choo Choo, you know, saying, well, I don't really know that we want to remove discretionary review for 100% affordable housing. Like, are you crazy? Like, what other affordable housing advocate on earth would ever want to give neighbors more power to say no to their project?
And that same discretionary review process and whatnot is what's killing the MEDA project on Shotwell that they're now dealing with.
What's MEDA?
Oh, sorry. MEDA is an affordable housing developer in the city. And so they're trying to do an 100% affordable housing project for seniors in the Mission. And, like, irony of ironies, wackos are coming out to oppose it and say it's too tall and there's too many units. And, you know, I mean, we're going to be out in force to support this 100% affordable housing project.
Just say, so MEDA is new to the housing development game. They've been a community service provider for many years, and they're partnering with another affordable housing developer to get this done. But, you know, it's so, you know, wonderful where you have the quote unquote progressives of Bernal Hill complaining about this project because this one woman, it will block her view, you know, and like, you know, some folks say, oh, you YIMBYs are always talking about how people are just concerned with their views and with parking and with shadows and wind tunnels. No one's that crazy. No one's that selfish. Come to these community meetings. Join us. This is really what they're concerned about. We're not making this up.
You forgot parking. Parking. Number one concern, parking.
All right. So we've gone kind of, we've moved into new territory here. So we've talked about the funding in local election, and then we've moved into kind of the history of the Progressive Party in San Francisco, and MEDA, and kind of the opposition, and even now parking. So I think we're probably, if you guys have anything else to add on the funding issue, because that was kind of the goal of this episode, let's add that now, and then we'll wrap up.
You know, I circle back to the soda money. You know, I wish I was getting some of that sweet soda money, because I don't know. I don't know if I would quite change. I actually haven't had any soda in 10 years. So I don't know if they would let me in the club. But I think it's worth noting the sort of role of things getting branded as progressive, even when they're really not. You know, I think the soda industry has done a really good job of selling a false bill of goods on this one, that soda taxes is a regressive tax. And I understand the appeal of that, you know, like low-income people drink more soda. You know, it's a product, you know, that anytime you have a sales tax, it's going to fall more heavily on people who, you know, sales is a larger percentage of their spending. But on the other hand, you know, diabetes is regressive. It's an expensive disease that falls more heavily on low-income people. I think that, you know, people are like worried about like the slippery slope then too. Like, oh, if you start, you know, taxing soda, then you're going to have to tax sugar. And I'm like, yeah, let's get to work dismantling the subsidies and the insanity that's happening in our food industrial complex. You know, that's a progressive move.
You know, look, I think actual dark money is a real problem. If people are donating vast sums of money to affect elections and we don't know who they are, that's a problem. But that's not what's happening here. What we're talking about are, you know, people who do have a stake in the future of San Francisco who want to elevate their voice. Now, I'm more than happy to have the conversation with anyone who wants to talk about limiting, you know, the role of money in politics. I think that's a worthwhile thing. But at the same time, like what Laura was saying earlier, you know, it also does make sense for these individuals to be donating. When I've talked to leaders in the tech industry, they get, you know, headaches and heartburn over the stories from their employees and potential recruits about the high cost of housing. You know, they really do feel for them. Like they want to make this easier, and they're sick of, you know, so much of their, you know, profits or, you know, investment money just lining the pockets of landlords. It's a really unfortunate situation. And so I really do believe that many of these tech leaders, they really are looking at this from the position of the number one concern of my employees right now is the cost of living. How do I help fix this problem for them? One way to help fix this problem is to elect people who will allow more housing to be built in San Francisco.
I do think that it's worth noting, if this was the oil industry, right, we would be feeling really different. And it's also why we have like a visceral, I think it's who do you have a visceral reaction to? We, frankly, you know lots of tech workers. I'm married to one. Like we know tech. We, you know, that's a large part of our, you know, volunteers and whatnot. I think we're predisposed to not see tech as a sinister force in the city. You know, I think that's our bias. And I think, you know, we're definitely predisposed to seeing soda as an evil industry similar to the cigarette lobby. I'm still not sure we're wrong, but maybe that's my bias coming through. You know, I think if this was the oil industry backing us, I would freak out and go do something else. You know, but I think, you know, there are other actors too. You know, we've got the local chamber of commerce has been pretty active in local politics for many years. You know, anybody, you know, it's a weird thing where I see, you know, it's a weird thing in San Francisco politics when you have the laborers aligning with the employers, right? When labor aligns with employers to both fight for more housing or for, you know, progress to be made, you know, I think you can see that things are broken, like, right? Like where the line should fall, I think, is almost always labor versus employer, right? That's where conflict should be having. Something has to be fundamentally broken in the system for both labor and the mass employers to be fighting for the same reforms and the same policies.
And at the same time, I think it's important to think about the fact that tech companies employ not just engineers, they employ a lot of other people. And I also think that we need to keep them honest and responsible for all of their employees. And that's where YIMBY definitely advocates for increased percentage of affordable housing and making sure that that's kept top of mind as development occurs. But blocking housing is not an effective strategy for anyone. Also, I kind of think, you know, you got to be able to make your own call. And I don't think that Brian's point was pedantic, actually. I think it's really important. I think that the difference between dark money and money in politics generally is really important. You can see when you get a flyer in the mail who's paying for that. And I think that's really important. And you should look at that and you should do your own research. And just because there's a lot of money being spent doesn't mean you need to be influenced by it.
Just throw out all that stupid campaign mail. I mean, this is the other thing. Like, nobody talks about how much money is wasted in politics, right? Everyone's so afraid of the money in politics when all the evidence, you know, the research says the money follows political will. It's not really the other way around. You know, the amount of influence that money has is much smaller than we think it is. I'm constantly irritated by the misspending of money in local politics. You know, how much money is spent on TV ads? And it's like, okay, people keep telling me TV ads, oh yeah, they're effective. And I'm like, I don't watch TV. I don't know anybody who watches TV. Like, are you sure TV ads are effective?
Political consultants who are getting a percentage of TV ad buys are very sure that they're effective. And I think that's another thing too, is you commented earlier how much more effective you think the soda industry is being in spending their money. Well, like you said, this isn't their first rodeo. They've been doing this before, and they really know what their core interests are. Meanwhile, a lot of these tech givers, they are new to local politics, and they are very reliant on existing political consultants to tell them how to spend their money, to tell them what's most effective. And while many of these tech donors are no doubt very brilliant people in their own areas, they don't have a whole lot of domain knowledge in local politics and what moves votes. And so I think your point is a correct one. I'm not convinced that a lot of this money is being spent all that effectively.
Yeah, I'm 100% convinced that a lot of it is being spent quite ineffectively. Yeah. Like, I am very sure. I don't, you know, we're going to do all the math at the end of this election. But the other thing is measuring your impact, and especially in local politics, is extremely difficult. You know, so there's a lot of debate about what's called visibility. So that's somebody standing on the corner handing out, you know, little flyers for their thing, or a sign. Some campaigns say visibility does nothing. Some people are like, oh, it's just that it, like, you know, evaporates into the ether. You can't measure it because, you know, everybody you hand a flyer to, you have no idea where they then go and vote. You know, these are long-standing debates in local politics. One thing that is not debatable is that an effective ground game is the number one mover. That's why Hillary Clinton is, you know, doing such an effective ground game, despite the fact that it looks like she's going to easily roll over Trump. You know, she is putting a huge amount of time and effort into the very old-fashioned get out the vote, canvass, you know, talking to voters, doing phone banks in those swing states. You know, we have been really underfunded in the ground game. People want to, like, send out a mailer, and that costs, you know, $40,000, when it's like, okay, I would much rather hire, you know, two or three organizers to mobilize voters.
That's a great point. And, you know, this isn't all that mysterious. Political scientists have been studying the efficacy of different types of political advertising and turnout models and ground games and all the rest. And what they found is that, yes, funding a ground game does work. Now, it doesn't move the needle by as much as we would like, but there is much better evidence that a dollar spent, you know, funding canvassers to go out, knock on doors, talk to their neighbors, is better than a dollar spent on TV advertisement, is better than a dollar spent on mailers.
And this is where the soda industry is smarter, because they are spending money on people who have voted their way, right? So it's, you have, like, Democratic clubs or whatever who are supporting the no on V, and they infuse them with money then so that they can go and send, you know, drop their lit and knock on doors much more.
All right. Thank you, guys. This was an awesome conversation. Before we wrap, any announcements?
Yes, there's going to be a YIMBY Halloween party at the YIMBY headquarters, 661 Natoma Street, during the day, probably around noon or so, Saturday, October 29th. And you're very much encouraged to dress up in some YIMBY themed way. Maybe go as a skyscraper, go as a planning commission with, you know, like, multiple heads dressed up. I mean, like, you can still make it scary and still make it be a YIMBY. So it should be a lot of fun, and we encourage everyone to come on out.
And another announcement, we are doing a big push on a Canvas Your Neighbors. So for those people who sort of struggle to come out for, you know, an all day canvassing event, you can do, you know, 20 minutes after work every day. We'll give you lit and we'll set you up on your phone so you'll be able to see sort of who the all our targeted voters near you are. It's really easy. It's a fun way to get to know your neighbors. If you don't want to get to know your neighbors, you can pick a neighborhood, you know, sort of a little bit over from yours. but it's really easy and you can do it after work, you know, whenever kind of works for you. So it's a really, we try to make it easy here at YIMBY.
And as always, you can go to sfymby.org to donate and also share the podcast and share the website with your friends. Now's the time. The election's coming up. It's around the corner. And so it's time to mobilize. So thank you all and we'll see you next time.